And then they say things and do things, and then we get upset.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Thursday, May 17th, 2017.
18th.
Oh, it's May 18th. I just read the script, you know. It's May 18th, just anybody's question. Thank you. And I'm going to open an informational hearing today on children of incarcerated parents. So we have, looks like, five different panels. So I'll just call you up the way I have them listed unless somebody wants to change the order. So the first panel is Shannon White and Jeremiah Stoneberg. If you please come forward and just identify yourself for the record and make your comments.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is Shannon White, and I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide nonprofit that advocates for proven strategies that achieve safe and strong communities, prevent crime, and provide opportunities for both victims of crime and people who commit crimes to rebuild their lives. And I wanted to start out by saying just thank you so much for having this hearing. Most conversations around public safety end up in judiciary and the public safety subcommittee. And we know that crime, while it's often thought of as happening between two people, impacts communities and really importantly impacts children and families. And so having an opportunity to speak with you and look at that intersection is really welcome. In Oregon, we know that 75% of women in prison are mothers, and that the majority of these women are mothers to young children. And we also know that 40% of foster children have a parent in prison. And it's also really important to note that incarceration doesn't impact Oregon families equally. African American children are 7 times more likely to have a parent who is incarcerated. And while the data is a little rough, we also know that Native Americans and Latinos are disproportionately impacted by the justice system as well. And just to be clear on what I mean by the data is rough, we just don't collect great race data is what I mean, so it's harder to tell. And so we need more programs that support families impacted by crime and violence. And this also is relevant in a budget scenario. This session, we're actually facing the potential of having to open a second prison for women, 70% of whom are there for drug and property crimes, and again, who are also mothers, to the tune of nearly $20 million a biennium. And we know that a focus on families and children, that money could be better spent elsewhere. So we're working on that as well. So Jeremiah and I are here today to talk about a program called the Family Sentencing Alternative. Partnership for Safety and Justice work with Representative Williamson and Olson to pass this bill in 2015. And it was passed with broad bipartisan support. And we're back this session fixing it and expanding it, creating greater eligibility, particularly for mothers who are pregnant. The program is modeled after one in Washington State that has success in diverting custodial parents, so not just women, but custodial parents from prison as a priority. So looking at parents who might otherwise go to prison, who have custody of their children, and who could benefit from intensive probation services, treatment, and programming. The program is really driven by an effort to keep custodial parents with their children while they're held accountable for drug and property crimes. And while the program is relatively new, and Jeremiah will talk more about this, the results so far are promising. It's been implemented in Jackson, Marion, Multnomah, and Deschutes County, and if it weren't for the budget crisis, we would be advocating for it to be expanded into other counties. So hopefully that will come soon. And so we just want to say that this is the kind of program that we hope we can have more of moving forward, one that really looks at the total impact of crime and doesn't forget children and families in particular when we're thinking about how people are held accountable and how we provide services for them. So I want to thank you again for this conversation, and we really do look forward to that ongoing opportunity to make Oregon families safe and strong. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director of the Community Corrections Division with the Department of Corrections. And as Shannon pointed out, this is a pilot program that we've had the responsibility to administer in 5 counties. We started the program in January of 2016, and I have to tell you that to date, it has been a success. While it's early to look at long-term outcomes such as recidivism and whether or not folks maintain stable employment and housing. What we have seen is that the partnership between five counties, the Department of Human Services, and Department of Corrections has resulted in 75 participants who had 139 children in total who otherwise would have been in the foster care system or some other care had it not been for the ability of a program like this to exist. The partnership between the counties and the state has shown that we've been able to provide intensive supervision and parenting programs to this population. And as Shannon pointed out, as an ability to prevent us from having to open additional institutions. The programs for men and women and more women have been able to participate in the program to date, as we would assume, as being the primary caretakers of their children. And so it has had a direct impact on our ability to, while our Coffee Creek facility is still over capacity, it would be even more so if we didn't have programs like this available to us. In this session, and I think Shannon mentioned to it briefly, there's currently three bills that do expand the program as far as taking off some of the restrictive criteria that prevents some parents from being able to enter into the program. One of them is we'd clearly outlined that you had to be a parent at the time of your sentence. And yet we receive a lot of defendants who are pregnant at the time and we know would benefit highly from a program like this. And so what we didn't want to see is that small little technical details prevented someone that if the courts determined they should be on probation instead of prison, that this program is available and an option for the courts to weigh when making that consideration between prison and the community. Department of Corrections is committed to continue to help with the oversight of the program and the expansion as one of the three bills will most likely pass in some way, shape, or form. And we are committed not only to reducing our prison population and ensuring that only those who truly need to be in our custody and control are there, but that the counties have the resources they need to be successful in meeting not only the risks that these individuals present, but the needs that they have in being parents and involved in the criminal justice system at the same time. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions people have? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Mentioned three bills, one having to do with the expanding it to pregnant women as well. What's the number of that bill, and what are the other two bill numbers? And if another panel is going to address this, that's fine too. Okay.
Well, we're probably the right two people. So Chair Lively and yeah. Representative Kenny Geyer. Senate Bill 895 was the recommendations directly from the Department of Corrections to the Public Safety Task Force. And that bill does remove the restrictions that we were most concerned about when we looked at being able to get the most participants involved in the bill. In addition, House Bill 3078 and House Bill 3380 both do just about the same and add some language that the court shall consider this program as a mitigating factor when determining the sentence of an individual. So that one goes a little bit more broader and puts more of a responsibility on the judiciary to consider the program when making sentencing determinations. So hopefully that answers your question. Shannon may have a little more information.
And where are those bills now?
Let's see. One is in 3078 is a kind of larger package that includes it, and that is in House Rules. 3380 was just heard in Senate Judiciary but hasn't had a work session yet. And Senate Bill 895 is awaiting hearing on the House side.
Awaiting a hearing on the House side, yes.
Other questions? So I have a question. I don't have all the background in the program, so I'm trying to understand when you talked about the influence this could have in a sentencing or deciding it, but then I thought I heard you say something about the people that would qualify for this have to be on probation, or what's the link, I guess I'm trying to understand.
Chair Lively, the program is designed for those that have been departed from prison.
Okay.
To a probationary sentence. And so it does only meet a certain swath of the offender population, if you will, that falls within that category.
Sure.
So it was designed to be an alternative to custody, and where a court and a community can know we have the
the resources locally for this population.
And what's the length of time? Is there some restrictions? And I don't, obviously the probation time period could be different lengths. So what's the length of time with this program that a person could be part of this program?
Chair Lively, a minimum of 1 year is the ideal length. However, the community corrections agencies that are supervising have flexibility that if someone's moving more quickly and is eligible, safe to be discharged early, they can be. And if they need more time in the program, they can certainly stay in.
Very good. Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. So the next panel is Commander Jeff Wood and Deputy District Attorney Keir Betcher. Something like that. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Sure.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for letting us present here today. My name is Keir Betcher. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. And Commander Wood and I are here to talk about the Marion County 416 program and the FSAP program. Just in general, the Marion County Senate Bill 416 and FSAP program, they are alternative rehabilitative programs for nonviolent career, property, and drug offenders who have an identifiable substance abuse issue, a motivation to change their behavior, and parents and who are sometimes parents of minor children, which is really the FSAP model that we are implementing. I'm going to go over a little bit of the history of the 416 program, as well as the expansion into the FSAP program, as well as the district attorney's role in this program and its implementation here in Marion County. Now, the 416 program was introduced and developed in 2012. It was mainly a partnership between the Marion County Sheriff's Office as well as the District Attorney's Office here in Marion County. A lot of people came to the table from parole and probation, Sheriff Myers, District Attorney Beglaw, to really develop a program in order to divert repeat property offenders from their track to prison into some sort of rehabilitative, intensive supervision to really address the drug issues and really what's motivating them to actually engage in the criminal behavior. Around late 2012 to 2013 was when the program was actually launched and began to divert offenders into the program. Initially, we were allowed to have up to 60 members per year, and it was done by a financial year in terms of in July 2013 to then June 2014. The program was in place for about 2 years, and then in around 2015, we started to meet with individuals from the state of Washington about the FSAP program. In meeting with them, we realized that we had the infrastructure in place by way of 416 in order to adapt and include FSAP and start including members of the community that are custodial parents or are about to be custodial parents. So in the way in which this works from the DA side of things, currently, I'm in the domestic violence unit. However, I did work with the 416 program for many years. And with the 416 program, what the DA's role is really gatekeeper. When we get a case, it's all about swift identification and trying to get them swiftly into programs. Because, again, we are realizing that they need some sort of intervention quickly. We evaluate the offender as well as the crime. We look at things including where they live, where they maintain residency, because they have to be someone who lives in Marion County, whether or not they are a repeat property offender, therefore qualifying them as a presumptive prison sentence. And then we're also looking to see if there's some sort of substance abuse problem that is prevalent by way of the conduct or by way of the criminal record. From that point on, we really look at the criminal record to see if there's any automatic exclusions that we would look to say, well, you would not be eligible for this program. Such exclusions would include prior sex convictions, sexual assault convictions, prior domestic violence convictions, as well as felony person crime convictions, serious mental health issues that the person may be suffering from that may be better served through a different program. We're not specifically excluding them and saying we're just going to send you to prison. It's just this might not be the best program to serve your needs. And or if there is some sort of vulnerable victim or an abuse of trust relationship between the offender and the victim of the crime. Of note, I would want to make sure that I indicate that the felony person crime conviction piece, that's not an automatic exclusion for us. A lot of times we weigh that prior conviction. We will actually look sometimes and pull the prior police reports to see what were the circumstances that led to that prior person's conviction. So oftentimes that is not an automatic exclusion. It becomes something that we will weigh in determining whether or not we will move them forward in the process. Other considerations that we'll also take under account are a pattern of repeated instances of failure to appear, repeated probation violations. Is this person even going to be a good probation candidate if we divert from the presumptive prison? Once we conclude that look into this person's background, we'll look into this crime, we then run their criminal history through a public safety checklist that gives us ultimately a percentage score, and that the percentage basically tells us, well, what is the rate in which they're going to commit this crime again if there is no sort of intervention at this point. We like to say that we take medium to high-risk offenders. However, we also know that sometimes we will get members who show a very low risk of repeated criminal behavior, but we know, just to know what we do, that in actuality, based on their criminal history, this person is very, very high risk for repeat offending. So we still qualify even people who are technically low offenders into the 416 and or FSAP program. If they meet all those general criteria, we send off an email to the probation department, and they can begin their evaluations. We also let the jail know, because that way that person will remain likely in custody, because there are some dedicated jail beds as well. And as I'm going to do right now as part of this presentation, we then hand off to the probation department, and I'll hand off to
Excellent. Good job. Perfect.
Yeah. Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I'm a division commander with the Maryland County Sheriff's Office. As Kira eloquently stated, we do have our Family Sentencing Alternative Program. Our FSAP program kind of is almost a subdivision of our 416, but for purposes of brevity, I'll kind of focus on our Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. As Kier mentioned, again, we go through the gamut of assessments, and while Kier will mention that initial assessment they do, sometimes they are lower risk. We do a variety of different assessments. We do an LSCMI, we do public safety checklist, and we do a specific to the female population assessment called the WERNA. And I think what's interesting about that is the WERNA is actually designed specifically for women, and it actually assesses the risks and needs for women involving trauma, relational issues, parenting stress, and depression. Those of you may or may not know, the Marion County Sheriff's Office, we do a jail and transition center survey. One of the things that we found was that for purposes of the female population alone, we found that about almost 90% of that population had suffered from physical or sexual abuse of some sort. I'm bringing that up only in the context that once somebody is accepted into our program, we take that into account. We do a trauma-informed care. That's part of the delivery of services. We have a very specific probation officer that's assigned to this caseload, and they have a coordinated case plan with DHS, child welfare. We make sure that they have the called criminogenic needs met. We provide housing, we provide mentoring, we provide CADC, a certified treatment provider. And we're in constant communication, not only with DHS, but also the district attorney's office. I know this won't shock the committee, but when somebody takes 30 years to get into a certain point of their life where they're in need of, say, addiction treatment or mentoring or parenting classes, it doesn't happen overnight in terms of that positive pro-social change. And so we realize that there will be violations. There probably will be drug use. There may be a failure to attend a treatment appointment. That said, we are in agreement that short, swift, and certain sanctions are part of that milieu that we offer. We hold people accountable, yet we also try, I'll say it modestly, our goals are simple yet profound, where we try to preserve the family and family unity. We try to hold the clients accountable, but we also want to do it in a safe environment for our community where recidivism is reduced. And in line with that, as Jeremiah pointed out, I think locally in Marion County, we have 25 participants in the FSAP program to date, and these are close to 18-month numbers. I believe we only have one that's been turned over, I'll say, to the Department of Corrections. And so we feel like we have a very good success rate. In fact, the women and their children are responding well. I wish I could have brought the probation officer who's in charge of this program. If you felt her energy and her enthusiasm for this, she is involved, to put it mildly. And one of the tenets that we learned from the Washington State program is that PO involvement. The PO can be both a role model and somebody that holds the person accountable. We reward good behavior. We try to appropriately disapprove of poor behavior and hold them accountable. And she does that. She does that phenomenally well, as I think is kind of demonstrated by some of our outcomes to date, and hopefully they will continue. The one thing I will say, and I think Keir mentioned it, if there was one thing we could do, and several of the bills were mentioned, that takes off some of the sideboard, so to speak, for family sentencing alternative. We have found one or a couple instances where one of the prohibitions for family sentencing to be sentenced as part of this program is a person felony. And before I say this, let me be clear, I'm not advocating for violent felons to be part of this program. But I would suggest that there is sort of a subtle nuance between a property crime to a person crime. The difference between a theft and a robbery is somewhat subtle, and it's a simple impulse, inability to control an impulse, shoving someone away from stealing something. And we have had a case where somebody was convicted of a robbery, appropriately so, I might add, but can't be part of this program. Nonetheless, and the Department of Corrections pointed it out to us, and they were absolutely right in their assessment. The person did not qualify. I think my only point is that even though this person cannot qualify for FSAP, the district attorney's office, the sheriff's office, we were all in agreement that this person would be warranted. We still have assigned this person to the same PO. This person is still receiving many of the same services, but due to circumstance, they can't receive that coordinated case planning through DHS like we do the other participants. And again, I'm not excusing the action, but sometimes when we look at some of those parameters and those sideboards, we might want to look at that person felony as not necessarily a disqualifying factor. And with that, I am open to questions. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can correct my numbers where my one number where it's wrong. So it's approximately $10,000 to educate a child in our public school system in the state, but $30,000 to house a person in our system per year. And so we have these diversion programs. How much are we saving? And I'm not even asking you to quantify the community impact, because, I mean, that'd be a whole different category. But what's the decrease in the $30,000 for this program?
You want me to? Representative Bynum, Chair Lively, members of the committee. Hopefully these numbers will make sense. We do look at some of the daily costs, and maybe I can go into a daily rate formula. I believe that, you know, our local jail costs roughly $144 a day. Department of Corrections, I believe, is about $100 a day. Supervision for people who are in the medium to high risk are around $16 a day. That said, there are additional funds for this program, and what we've probably the best estimate I could give you is about $30 to $35 a day, but that also includes the services that we provide to the children too. And we have 25 people, I believe, in our program right now, and that represents about 48 children. And so, those savings, I would say, not only for the Department of Corrections and DHS, I think, reflect in that $30 to $35 per person per day.
Can I push a little bit? So when we look at how much we're spending to educate our children versus how much we're looking at to reform people who have made poor choices, and we're looking at a budget right now that I think a corrections budget is about, what, $1.8 billion in our state, and we have a potential $1.8 billion gap. How can you all be more helpful in continuing to be helpful and helping us close those gaps and making sure that our communities are safe and we're not encouraging recidivism by continuously cycling people through the correction system?
Representative Bynum, Chair Lively, members of the committee, probably, and I may not be getting to what it is you're asking. Hopefully Jeremiah will nod when I say this, but I believe about 90 to 93% of everybody gets out of the Department of Corrections at some point. So nonetheless, whether we get them at the front end or the back end, we will be supervising these people. They will return to our community. They are members of our community and people that we know and know well. I believe there is savings at the front end if we do not send them to 36 months of Department of Corrections time. If you multiply the $100 per person per day over 3 years versus the 18 months of supervision where we are starting to get people off of supervision, there is a net savings. Nonetheless, those costs in a way are unrealized in that, and I think Jeremiah mentioned this. Obviously, beds are still being occupied at DOC. It's not like we're shutting institutions down, but nonetheless, if Marion County, we did not have these 25 that we're managing in the community, that would put severe pressure on the Department of Corrections in terms of what their needs are. And so I would argue that not only are we saving money on a daily rate with this population safely managed within the community, but we're also not putting unnecessary stress in that, I think, $17 to $20 million price tag for opening up a new institution for women.
So, yes, Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Chair Lively. So I would just like to add, first of all, I'm really, really jazzed about the woman's piece that you mentioned. I think that's really a strong, strong opportunity. I think the next panel will be able to talk a little more succinctly than I can around it, but I think that's great. But I bet I've said almost every day that I worked in law enforcement, we can never quantify what we prevent. And so to put a dollar amount, I just always want to say we need to realize that there are things happening, good things around law enforcement and every program we're hearing about today that is saving this state money. Mm-hmm. And appreciate the great work.
Thank you.
So, Kira, I have a couple of questions. So
yes,
you talked, and I believe the term you used was career offender.
Yes.
So help me understand, how do you define, or how does a person become a career offender versus just an offender?
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. With regards to a repeat property offender, I'm really making reference to a statute. It's ORS 137717, which is it's called the repeat property offender statute, essentially. So when we're talking about a career offender, there are oftentimes mentions of career offenders in our criminal statutes when talking about graduated penalties. So I borrow the career offender from other statutes as well. But really, I'm referring to ORS 137717. With regards to what qualifies an individual, then, to be a repeat property offender, there's multiple ways in which they can do it. The most, what I would say, classic one that we see is that they have two prior convictions for a particular qualified type of property crime. What's interesting about the way that ORS 137717 is drafted is it doesn't include particular crimes. Fraudulent use of a credit card as being a predicate is not one. Organized retail theft is not a predicate. However, theft in the second degree, stealing something between the value of $100 to $1,000, that is a predicate. So if you have two prior theft in the second degrees, two prior shoplifts from Winco, suddenly, you know, you use someone else's credit card, you get an identity theft, you are now eligible as for 18 months in the Department of Corrections. Other ways to get there are if you're convicted of one of those predicate offenses and you are on probation or you completed probation within 3 years of the within the time of that crime, of your new crime. Another way is if you do have a prior offense for a higher level property offense, aggravated identity theft, robbery in the first degree, robbery in the second degree. If you only have one of those, your next property offense will trigger right then and there to be at the either presumptive 18 months starting or the 24 months starting. So that's kind of the background, the general idea as to how you get to the presumptive prison location that then you ultimately end up being potentially eligible for FSAT as well.
Okay. And I appreciate the conversation about the intake, all the evaluation and that is done on both sides. Help me understand how long a process that is.
It's Chair Lively, members of the committee, when I say it out loud, it probably seems like it takes me a while or it takes other deputies in our office to do it. However, we are seasoned. We are seasoned at reviewing CCHs. We are seasoned at reviewing, and when I say CCHs, I'm referring to someone's criminal history. We are seasoned at reviewing police reports. And we are seasoned at knowing really what the label of a crime, what conduct that equates to. So when I was doing this on a daily basis, this evaluation would take me 5-10 minutes to do. At least to review. It doesn't take me 5 or 10 minutes to review a police report. I can get a quick summary by reading a probable cause statement, understand the conduct, and then once I am able to establish this is a property offense by looking at the criminal history, there's drugs motivating this behavior, then I just start to move forward with looking at the criminal history for the domestic violence conviction, sex conviction. So it's a very quick process. And again, I'll say that's so important to the vitality of this program, mm-hmm. because really it allows us to be able to identify this person in need and swiftly, within that 15-minute period, contact the jail, contact parole and probation to say, let's get them evaluated and let's start getting them services to really address the major issue here.
Okay. And I assume that the number is just predicated on the number of resources that we have available. I mean, there's probably far more people that would qualify for the program if we had the resources to direct that.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, we have added, in terms of, there's always sort of, there's the baseline funding for community corrections, there's justice reinvestment, and obviously family sentencing. They all add on one another, so that kind of the program is not totally funded with just the mm-hmm. FSAP money. Mm-hmm. But I will say, again, maybe to underscore what Kieran mentioned, this is designed to be swiftly processed throughout our system. And I remember when we were first meeting about Senate Bill 416, one of the deputy DAs, you know, had made a comment about, well, we could have somebody through our process in 7 days. Are you able to handle that? And the answer was yes. I'm not sure he wanted that answer at the time. I'm kind of joking as I say that.
Right.
But it is designed to be swift in that when, for those of you who don't know, the public safety checklist is putting an SID number into a database that gives you a result. They coordinate an appointment with us. Candidly, if the person is in custody, it goes a lot swifter because we have a captive audience, so to speak. Even if they're out of custody, I will say they're highly motivated to be part of this program. One, I think they see the benefit of it, too. But two, not going to prison has certain advantages to them, too. And so we're able to get this very swiftly through the process because we want them to be on supervision and receive services as soon as we can. We think that's paramount.
Great. Thank you. Anything else? Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Just a little history. So you remember the public safety summits that were around the state back in 2014. I was a former county commissioner in Curry County and helped start those public safety summits. That's why we had the first one in Curry. Appreciate what Justice Reinvestment is doing. And there's lots of things that you've spoke about and others that, you know, keeping them, giving them the tools so that they don't, you know, fall back into the recidivism pattern, but keeping them close to their family network so that they can have their peers, if you will, assist mm-hmm. with the process. But we know that it saves the state millions of dollars, keeps us from opening up that other prison or building a new one, excuse me, and I just appreciate all the efforts and the comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this doesn't go on in Oregon. It's in other states that you hear that it goes on. But one thing I haven't heard is, as I was a legislator in another state, and I had constituents that had been incarcerated come back into the community. Their history haunted them with law enforcement, district attorney, etc. Under Justice Reinvestment and these programs, where we're keeping certain offenders in the community on probation, working through programs and support systems, do you find that there's a different attitude or more of a buy-in? Of course, I'm kind of baiting you that you would have to agree that you have actually seen those coming back in trying to re-enter have maybe been treated. I want to be careful because law enforcement, everybody has a tough job. They're trying to keep everybody safe, and I get that. But sometimes I've witnessed where maybe somebody just didn't get quite the fair shake, and they were almost helped into reoffending. Trying to be really careful here, but do you in the programs, do you see a different attitude where there's a little more of a wraparound effect with law enforcement and others to try to help the person on probation and in the program succeed?
So, Representative Huffman, Chair Lively, members of the committee, short answer is absolutely. I really, really do. In my work as a deputy district attorney, I oftentimes see offenders multiple times. In Marion County, I have seen offenders go through prison, come back out, and now they're back on my desk. And I've seen those individuals qualify for 416, and I do see a change. And I do see a change in demeanor, and I see a change by way of working with the probation department. And I think it's exactly those reasons that you brought up, and that's the reasons why it works. These wraparound services, I think there is an extra attention from these dedicated probation officers. We have two specifically in the 416 program. We have one specifically for the FSAP program. And there is a dedication both from the district attorney's office and from the probation department that I think the offender can see. Oftentimes, we, in their first cycle through, when maybe they were thrown to the wayside, sent to prison, or they were given a probationary opportunity and then were revoked after being picked up with methamphetamine in their pocket, we treat these offenders differently in order to gain their trust, in order for them to trust us to help them to move forward. And so I do think that there is a huge difference in this program than maybe prior cycles of supervision for these offenders, prior experiences in the Department of Corrections, because this is really about building the bridge with the offender, finding out what is not even just why they, not even that the fact that they do drugs, but why do you do drugs? And why do you, why are you addicted to these things? So we can really get to the root and really start changing those behaviors. And the way in which we do short, swift sanctions, and the way in which we communicate between the probation department and the district attorney's office, and oftentimes our office will not file new felony crimes for methamphetamine. We'll oftentimes will not file non-person offenses for criminal trespass in the first degree or criminal trespass in the second degree, where it appears as though there's not really a harm to the community. It's more of a harm of, the, of their circumstance. Because again, we want to make sure that they were building trust and we're getting to the root of the issue. So I think that they see that we treat them in a different way once they get into this program. I will be honest, I read police reports where they're talking with law enforcement and they are angry, they are not receptive, they're not open. But again, once we're able to start working with them and we identify them as a 416 probationary candidate, and then once they enter the program, we treat them in a way in which we're trying to build that trust and trying to ultimately get reform. So I think that yes, there is a change.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate it. You made my other point. This one thing I appreciate is you work to get to the root problem. What's the cause? What's causing this? More from a trauma-informed aspect. And nothing against DOC and what goes on there. There's a purpose, but oftentimes not the ability to spend the time with the individual to get to the root of the problem, and so they recidivate, and yeah. You know, so thank you.
Maybe if I could, Representative Huffman, Chair Lively, members of the committee, the one thing I would add, and Kier said it so well, there was a day and a time, even on the probation side, where we weren't exactly looking for success. Marion County, there was a day and a time when we had one of the highest recidivism rates in the state. We applied what's called a broken windows philosophy to our community supervision, and we arrested a lot of people for violations. And really, candidly, we revoked a lot of people, too. We thought we were doing what was in the public's interest. You know, one of the advantages of Senate Bill 267 back in 2003, when evidence-based practices were being implemented, was we realized, and I'm not proud of this, we were wrong, candidly. We were very wrong. We were doing a bad way of business, and we are relying on assessments. And I know that sounds a little almost clinical, but we use those assessments to address what factors are prevalent in their life, likely to incite them to commit future criminal acts and try to address those issues. And one of the things, too, Marion and some of the other FSAP counties are what we call EPICS counties, where stands for Effective Practices and Community Supervision. One of the key tenets of that program is to be a good role model. We're not saying that we ignore violations or we make special deals, but where appropriate, we reward good behavior. We try to look for good behavior and stand alongside our clients so they can be successful. And I think that's significantly changed our attitude within the sheriff's office. And maybe most importantly, it's significantly decreased our recidivism rate, whereas we were one of the highest. I like to think we compete with being one of the lowest now. And I think that's had a positive impact on our community.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Susan Stoltenberg and Jessica Katz.
Good afternoon. Excuse me, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, committee members. For the record, my name is Jessica Katz, and I am the director of the Family Preservation Project at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for the YWCA of Greater Portland. And I'm also, like Shannon had mentioned, thrilled that this conversation is happening in this committee. It's the very place that I have thought for many, many years that this conversation should also be taking place. And I just want to talk a little bit about the project. We're going to move into a conversation about two bills that we have in front of the legislature this session. And I have worked in the prison system for about 16 years. And I've been really struck by what happens to kids and the lack of conversation that happens around what happens to kids. I think what's important to really understand is that the incarceration of the parent is really not necessarily the pivotal traumatic event that these kids have experienced. The road to prison is long and it's winding, and I know that some of you have law enforcement backgrounds and understand this more intimately. So for the kids, it's really a culmination of a series of traumatic events. We've heard some of the drivers from some of our previous presenters that why women wind up in prison. They're heavy trauma loads, their addiction backgrounds, and their own traumatic childhood experiences. And I am very thrilled also that the presenters that came before us are looking at alternatives to incarceration. And I would agree that there are far better alternatives to criminalizing some of the things we see, poverty, addiction, mental illness. And I think we are also committed to working towards those solutions. But we are in the midst of a crisis, as also our former presenters have mentioned, about looking at opening a second women's prison at the tune of $19 million, I think somewhere around that over the next biennium. And so I think that as we work towards better solutions overall, we also need to talk about what's happening in real time and safeguarding the kids. So kids have been victims of this system for a long time. And I think at a minimum, if we all recognize that an incarceration, as traumatic and devastating as it is, also creates an interruption. And what happens during that interruption is something I think that we need to come to some consensus about. So one thing that can happen during that interruption is that nothing happens, and we continue to not have a conversation around kids and families. And one of the things that can happen is that we capitalize on the opportunity to do something different. And as we talk about the overall forecast for our state budget, I think a very important conversation to have is if during that interruption there is some work towards keeping families preserved and averting foster care placements for kids and attending to their needs, that really translate, and I can't quantify it, I wish I could, into an overall savings in the state. So as a for instance, in one component of our program, which is a very intensive component, we have 12 moms, 25 kids, and of those, in real time right now, I think because there is some attention being given to preserving those families and keeping kids attending to their well-being, these are kids that are not going into the foster care system who otherwise might. And so that translates into an overall savings for the state. I think it's important to note that to lose one's dignity and liberty and be separated from the people that you love is a pretty high-stakes game. And it's too high to not take every opportunity to dig in and do something different. And the cost of doing nothing is pretty high. I think there is a strong return on investment in prevention and intervention, which is what the Family Preservation Project is attempting to do. And through its investment in the Family Preservation Project, the state has demonstrated its commitment to making this happen. We thank you. We continue to need your support. And we are going to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 241 and Senate Bill 242. Senate Bill 242, we will discuss, would provide continuing funding for the Family Preservation Project and its expansion. Senate Bill 241 addresses moving the conversation like from practice to policy and really safeguarding kids who are impacted by the system through an articulated Bill of Rights.
Thank you. For this opportunity, Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susan Stoltenberg. I'm the executive director of the YWCA, which is the sponsor today and has been for almost 2 years of the Family Preservation Project, which is a program that Jessica Katz developed and that a lot of courageous people are here to talk about. I'm going to try not to duplicate things that have already been said, so we'll slide over this, which is that 74% of incarcerated women have not been convicted of a violent crime, and there are reasons for being there, as the previous panel discussed very well, are very often related to their mental health needs and drug addictions, more so than the male population in prison. There are apparent and also hidden costs to parents' incarceration. First of all, there are court fees, and those fees that then when the incarcerated person is released, they have to pay back. Then there are costs to communicating with family. Every phone call costs something. Commissary, things like personal hygiene products cost something. In addition, the family has lost financial support. Very often, the medical insurance. And families, particularly families not in receiving DHS support, may be fearful, are fearful of enrolling their children in the CARE Oregon or Affordable Care Act because of their concern about trying to avoid additional involvement with systems. And as a result, they're both while she's incarcerated and after she's released, the family experiences chronic health problems, poverty, usually they have come out of poverty before they got there, and joblessness. Their incarceration prohibits their ability to receive, for example, Section 8 for housing. Their incarceration prohibits their ability to collect TANF except for their children. So you release a woman, you want her to reunite, she has no way to find housing, and she has no way, no means of support. And often it's also, as you know, because you've passed laws helping us in this regard, joblessness is, or particularly gainful employment, and certainly professional employment is prohibited. So as a result, not surprisingly, we see recidivism back into the kinds of behavior that allow them to support themselves, and that recidivism ultimately travels down to the children and their involvement in systems. So kids often get involved in the juvenile system. A lot of our work within FPP is connecting kids in one system to a parent who's in another system. We connect, and then child welfare at a cost of about $30,000 per year. That doesn't include all the court-associated costs. Mental health system, mental health is a very prevalent among mental health needs, I should say, among children of incarcerated parents. And so is school failure. They are four times as likely to fail in school. Well, where does that lead? That leads down the same path that led to the problems to begin with. And the parent also cannot receive food stamps. So they end up in shelters, and ultimately our communities pay the high, high, high price. So the Family Preservation Project was developed, and I'll let Jessica talk about the elements of that.
So if any of you followed the Family Preservation Project restart in the last legislative session, some of the things that had come up in conversation were the dollars that were spent on a small group of women and children. And so as we talk about the project, it is most often known for the smaller and more intensive component of the program, which serves, as I had mentioned, a cohort of 12 women, 25 kids, and their caregivers. So it's an intergenerational intervention that recognizes that the boots on the ground who are caring for the kids for 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, are not the women who are incarcerated, but it's either the family members that have stepped up into that position. And these are folks who had sometimes very little ability to plan financially, emotionally, and maybe are under-resourced to do the job, but they do the job. So the program serves those folks in addition around supporting them, creating community, connecting them to supports. Also serves the women who are incarcerated very intensively, 3 or 4 times a week. All the staff members in the program are master's level mental health trained practitioners and work with women to identify the root causes of why they're there again and try to address them to the extent that we can while simultaneously really looking at the well-being of their kids. Does the person who's caring for them have any legal footing to do that? Are they able to take them to doctor's appointments? Can they enroll them in school? These are things that are oftentimes left in the ephemera because we don't have really systems that address them. Looking a lot at kindergarten readiness and equity. It's an early intervention program, so we're looking at younger kids and also serve any of their siblings. But we know that kindergarten readiness is predictive of, you know, third grade reading levels, eighth grade graduation, then high school graduation, and that kids of incarcerated parents are also often not on equal footing with their peers due to the circumstances that they have experienced. So really looking at making sure kids are enrolled in high-quality preschools, Head Start programs, that their health needs are being addressed, that they're getting mental health support if they can, that their mom is involved in their parent-teacher conferences, that she's emailing back and forth with the teachers during her incarceration, so she's involved as she can possibly be. So it's a very intensive program, and it is small, and it's by design. Which does not speak to the need that exists when we're talking about 1,400 around women who are incarcerated at Coffee Creek, and we are on the minimum side. And what we learned was that there were so many systemic barriers to women being able to participate in this intensive program. Some of the collateral consequences to becoming incarcerated are that the relationships that exist have been destroyed on your path to Coffee Creek, and the person who's caring for your kids isn't your biggest fan and is not wanting to bring your kids on Saturdays to spend 3 hours in a therapeutic visit with you, which is also a component of the program. So over the years, we have really tried to study the population and understand where we can intervene and how. And so we've built the program out significantly, which now includes a family resource center. We have a monthly speaker series. And some of the things that come through our door are women who say, my child's in foster care. I've never talked to the caseworker. I just got a notice in the mail that I have a termination of parental rights hearing coming up. I don't know if I can go. I don't know if I can be on the phone. I haven't gotten any visits with my kids. The phone systems are not always set up so that you can call your caseworker's office. The phone systems aren't set up so that you can call your attorney's office. So while the foremost thing on your mind is often your children, you're really stuck in a way that you can't move this conversation forward or help them. So the Family Resource Center is an outgrowth of the original Family Preservation Project and is currently serving about 80 additional women and their children, and we've been able to extend some of the early childhood supports to that population as well. And to be as inclusive as we can of all women in the facility, we developed a monthly speaker series around some of the drivers that we know bring women to prison, so issues around wellness, legal issues, reentry issues, parenting issues, and we have very kind and generous experts and community members who come and volunteer their time at Coffee Creek monthly, and we serve as many women as can fit in the chow hall, which is 150, according to their fire code, and we routinely have upwards of 100 to 150 women attending. And our intent there is to really just offer some hope and some guidance and some information, and sometimes women who have given up hope as they're sitting at Coffee Creek thinking about their kids but have all of these barriers, somebody will come in and say something or give them one piece of information will help them put the next foot forward to help make things look different. So that's the current iteration of the program, which is different than the last iteration of the program. And this is largely due to the administration of the YWCA. It's been a really wonderful partnership, and the Y has been able to be incredibly successful in leveraging dollars to meet the state's investments so that we've been able to really expand and grow the program.
So why focus on mothers? 84, by the way, we all have different statistics, and I don't know. But 84% of incarcerated mothers had at least one child living with them. Secondly, they're the most rapidly growing as a percentage of the of the incarcerated population. Their children are 2.5 times more likely to become incarcerated than children of fathers who are incarcerated. And that has to do with who was custodial, I think. And then connectivity with family is a leading factor of avoiding future recidivism. In the last 18 months, we've saved the state $300,000, as you heard, if we just take the 10 kids that we know were headed for foster care and say they didn't go there. And the state invested $400,000. My guess is we saved a lot more than that long term. We have had feedback from Department of Corrections, who is supportive of our program now, which has been a huge turnaround from two years ago. And they believe that the women that we're working with, by and large, are also easier to work with. Why? Because they're back to being connected to people they love, which is the reason why they're trying to change their lives. And then finally, the kids are their leading academic indicators are improved by contact with mom. So what we believe is that an investment in 242 and the Family Preservation Project of $400,000 for a program that actually on a biennium costs closer to $800,000, the YWCA picks up the other, and we don't. We rally other community resources who help make that happen. That we're avoiding foster care, we're keeping the number of changes a child has to experience while a parent is incarcerated from home to home. We're minimizing that. We're improving the chances. Out of 65 graduates of that intensive program, only two of those women have recidivated over 6 years. So that intensive program is particularly effective. And we haven't measured it because the Family Resource Center has really only been up for about 14 months. So we will have more measures for you, hopefully 2 years from now. We believe that this is, and these are some of our supporters for our continued funding. We believe that an investment is the mission of is consistent with the mission of the YWCA, which is why we're proud to be here. That really what our program does is helps eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. It's why we are so proud of this program. And those three objectives really find their nexus when we're talking about incarcerated women and their families. We have received recognition nationally. Piper Kerman was here 2 weeks ago, feels like a long time ago, was on television and after she had visited with us and learned more about the program, said that in her opinion, this is one of a handful of stellar programs nationally that needs to be replicated, and particularly for the low price tag that we have on it. So Yes Magazine has featured us as as Oregon's top solution for this state. Were we the only one in Oregon? Yeah. And we continue to the movie now. We're working on a second movie. The first one was Mothering Inside, a documentary of the experience of incarceration, of the Family Preservation Project. And the second one that we're working on with Brian Lindstrom also is the experience of parental incarceration through the eyes of the child. And that is a segue to why we introduced Senate Bill 241, which is the Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents. And I believe the panel coming up after me is going to give you more detail about the why. But this is the what. 241A, which passed unanimously on the Senate side. I don't know if I should even mention that in here. I don't know whether that's good or bad.
It's good.
It's good.
I heard it was very unusual. And really nicely, many of the people here are graduates of our Family Preservation Project were here to hear it pass on the Senate floor. So it was very exciting. It was our lobby day. And all of these really say that when you remember that when you incarcerate, when you arrest, incarcerate, and release a mom, you're sentencing the whole family in a direction that we could have more control over and that that needs to be considered, and that every time you touch that mom, that child needs to be considered. So that's a abbreviation of what that means. Okay. Am I supposed to do this one, too?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. So 1 in 14 kids, but absolutely, again, it's the nexus of poverty and race when we start talking about incarceration. Half of the children of incarcerated parents are under the age of 10, so very fragile age. 1 in 8 of those kids were living in poverty, and 1 in 9 were African American. They're 4 times more likely to end up in juvenile detention facilities. Again, this is all related to the trauma that my predecessor did a great job of describing. 3 times more likely to drop out of high school, and African American children are 65% more likely to be homeless. We need to do something. Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you. I'm interested in the intersection of this and housing in particular. Mm-hmm. And I thought Section 8 was available for people who have been incarcerated, except for in sex abuse and meth production. I'm not sure about that. So I was curious about that, but also bigger question than that. Have you intersected at all with the rent guarantee program or the rent well program?
Yes.
So maybe you can address that, because I know housing is, like you said, absolutely critical.
It is critical.
If people aren't going to go back under a safe roof over their head.
Right. It is absolutely the biggest issue. Am I right? When we come out, it's the biggest issue. The YWCA, I'm the executive director of the YWCA, but I was at Impact Northwest, which has a huge housing program. The YWCA also operates a deep and wide domestic violence program. And we find that about 90% of the women that we work with admit that they've been sexually abused or victims of domestic violence. So there's enormous overlap. And housing is the biggest challenge also in domestic violence. So we network. We're a part of the housing partnership and all of the planning that's going on in the continuum of care. We also have we have 4 houses now that we just started this program in January called Shared Housing, where we have the master lease, and then groups of 5 to 10 people live together in these 5 to 10 bedroom homes, and they share the cost and the governance with our guidance of the housing. And we're hoping to replicate that outside the Portland area over time, because it's a nice, we can accept women who are also coming out of prison. I mean, we decide who lives there, and our model matches nicely the needs. Because often women with domestic violence have some of the same challenges as those who have been incarcerated in terms of mental health issues and, well, the things that trauma causes. Mm-hmm. And so we think it's going to be a good match. I personally think a lot of the women I've met coming out of incarceration, you know, they've been clean and sober for a while. So they're nice, strong influence in these houses of pretty fragile recent survivors. The other question was
the Section 8 question. Section 8 question. Do they qualify? What services do they or don't they qualify for?
I don't think I'm going to, but it has to do with the felony. Mm-hmm. And remember that if you've been convicted, if you're a mom and you did a drug deal and your husband did his drug deal out at the sidewalk, but your child was in the room when you did yours, now you've got a conviction also for child endangerment. Mm. So your profile looks differently than his. And then when you go to rent, if you've got a felony, including child endangerment, I think it's more, I think each state, our state, by the way, is very progressive. We're lucky. You all know that. So I think we've done more to mitigate the effect of that on employment and on housing. We need to get it off the housing application. The housing application, like we got it off the employment application. But depends on the subsidy is what I understand. It's not just Section 8. Remember, we have low-income housing tax credit, at least in the metro area. I think 16,000 units are Section 8, but there are another 14,000 or something that are, call it public subsidy, and that is restricted. But I don't know exactly what that is. Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I can get that if you want me to.
Yeah, that'd be good, because I've had other information about HUD not allowing any blanket bans like that on a felony other than a certain couple of categories. Mm-hmm. And so I would just love more clarification on that, what the barriers actually are.
I'll get it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet. Next panel, Kendra Wright and Nova Sweet.
Good afternoon, community members, or community members.
Yes, hopefully we are community members.
That's okay, thank you.
We are
our own little
community.
Try to be.
Yes, we're all the same members of community. My name's Nova Sweet, and I am a FPP graduate, former inmate at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and just a reformed individual, if you will. Real quickly, to clarify on your question from my experience about Section 8 TANF and food stamps, particularly in the housing area, is that HUD and Section 8 and subsidies are all different beasts. And I don't personally have that, but I have several friends who are on one of those. And the guidelines are different. Some of them, you can be a felon and jump through various hoops and get approved. However, you cannot have a felon move in on your lease. So maybe I am a felon and I go through the hoops to do that, but say I'm married and now my husband's a felon, he cannot come in and do it also. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's where the gray area is. As far as TANF and food stamps, there are also additional things that you have to do, but eventually you can get those things. But it's not as easy as walking out the gate and being eligible right away. So I don't know if that helps or not. I'm here to talk about the Family Preservation Project, but more so for the moms that do not benefit from any sort of additional support inside prison. Prison isn't supposed to be some, you know, resort getaway, although Coffee Creek is a really nice place, especially the minimum side. If I were to go to all-women's college somewhere, that's kind of how I imagine it to be, minus the fence. It's beautiful there. I love the trees, the gardens, they do a really good job. So I'm not here to say that the DOC or Coffee Creek should make it easier for people. That's clearly you've done something wrong. You need to go there. You need to be accountable. It's not supposed to be some resort. However, you know, lots of us are moms there, and there's not the opportunity to be able to communicate with your family. There's all sorts of barriers around really basic things. Being able to have somebody know how to register their phone so that you can call. It used to be that you could not call from a jail or a prison to a cell phone. That's changed, thankfully. But there's all sorts of things. So if the grandma is taking care of the kiddos and grandma has old flip phones, she might not be so savvy to be able to get the phone registered. So there's that barrier. There's also cost barriers, which have also improved. But if grandma can't afford to send money to help the person who's inside, which none of us like to ask for family support because you don't want to make people have to do the time with you. It's not, they didn't do anything wrong. So you're trying to do whatever you can do to be self-sufficient in there. But you At the same time, you don't make enough money in there to be self-sufficient, so to pay for your phone calls home or to pay for your commissary, which if you're a female, you have to pay for your, they provide pads, but you have to pay for your own tampons. You have to pay for deodorant, soap, shampoo, any of the razors, if that's, you know, if you choose to use that in your hygiene routine. They do provide you very small, like the travel size containers. You do get that on intake when you first go in, but that's not, you don't go back and turn it in and get a new one. It's not a resort, okay? You need to make it last and figure out how to survive on the inside. So what FPP does is allow you to be able to communicate with people and maybe maybe call grandma, but grandma knows that Uncle George can also help financially, but you can start networking and figuring out how to maybe get $20 on your books every month, which can pay for your hygiene. So there's that piece. Some other things that moms do not get as just being a part of the Department of Corrections and not part of the Family Preservation Project is being able to talk about what you're going through. You know, the department counselors, caseworkers, they're not therapists. They're not there to do that. They need to make sure the paperwork's taken care of. Safety and security is a priority. And we're asking them to do more than that, and that's not fair. The criminal justice or the prisons are there to help people be accountable. They're not there to therapize you and make you better. We're asking them to be a social service agency, and that's not okay. It's not fair. So you don't have somebody to talk to. And for women who are maybe still stuck in their addiction or they're, you know, self-defeating and they're like, oh, poor me, maybe they'll get involved in some low-level gang stuff or illegal activity and they'll become more of a nuance to the correctional officers, and that's not helpful. In the other paradigm of thinking, which when you're incarcerated, which was what I was a part of and she was a part of, being a part of FPP and just knowing that you wanted to do something different. You were there to fight for yourself and your family and you didn't want to be a part of that. So you do, you come become more of a model citizen and you don't, or a model inmate, and you don't go about and tell people how to act because nobody likes that in prison. You're not supposed to do that. But you do lead by example. And you know what? It's like, just like misery loves company, it's the other way around. Like, people start seeing that you're doing well, and you start treating people with respect, and you have a working relationship with the correctional officers, you keep your bunk area correctly, you show up places on time, you're not loud in your bunk area. Other people want to be like that, and they start wanting to, you know, learn from you. And so I think that support network, that the whole paradigm of family preservation getting better is super helpful. And for the chunk of women that don't have that, that it's really detrimental to everybody, them, their family, the DOC. I don't know. I could just go on and on about this, but that's what I got for now.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kendra Wright. I am a FPP graduate and advocate for the YWCA. I was incarcerated. I served 36 months. I have been out for almost 2 years now. I'm here to represent Senate Bill 241. During my incarceration, 3 months after being incarcerated, my rights were terminated, and I decided to appeal that termination. During that time, my daughter was not allowed to speak to me due to legalities and rules that are in place. My daughter was, she was 6 when I was incarcerated. By the time I got to see her, it had been 18 months. The only way that I could hear my daughter's voice was by my grandmother going into the room and speaking to my daughter and then getting to hear her through the phone. My daughter was not informed of what was going on or why, due to directions from DHS and other people involved in the situation. So currently, my daughter is now 11, and she has asked me questions like, Mom, why didn't you ever call me? Mm-hmm. Why couldn't I talk to you? Why couldn't I see you? And I would explain to her, you know, why the rules that were in place, you know, due to the courts and yada, yada, yada. And she recently informed me that she thought it was because I didn't want to talk to her, because that's what children do. You know, I was incarcerated due to my poor choices from an addiction, but ultimately she was the one that suffered. you know, I wasn't able to reverse the termination because all branches of courts, I've exhausted every avenue I can. They've all come back with the same result, that they don't have jurisdiction to reverse the termination in the state of Oregon. To me, that doesn't make sense. And I'm working with people to try to make that difference. It's a slow process. Yes, I know. My brain did the same thing. But it's my child who has suffered. There wasn't anyone in place to advocate for her. There's all these policies and procedures that are in place to protect our children, but they actually do the opposite. You know, there's these adults making choices for children without asking them what they want, or taking into consideration that mom is number one to their to this little girl or little boy. And the Bill of Rights would do just that. It would provide these things for the children. It would make all agencies be accountable and advocate for our children, which ultimately are our future. So, that's all I have.
Any questions?
Well, thank you. I just have a question about the termination process.
Okay.
That you went into jail and then they terminated and you had no voice in that process?
Well, I had an open DHS case prior to going to Coffee Creek. 3 months after my incarceration, they took me to a three-day trial. And based on my length of sentence and not meeting the standards that were in place from DHS, which were being in a treatment program, but when you get to Coffee Creek, you are not eligible for treatment until you have done 80% of your time. Mm-hmm. I was not eligible for parenting programs, which were part of the stipulation as well. But again, you must be a certain level and be there for a certain amount of time before mm-hmm. being qualified. So by no fault of my own, I just didn't meet the qualifications. Mm-hmm. They also were pushing for a plan of permanency. My daughter is in my grandparents' custody, mm-hmm. who were actively involved in my life, mm-hmm. and there was no reason that a plan of guardianship should have been in place, but mm-hmm. the state really pushed for a plan of termination. Mm-hmm. There's kind of this generalized precedence that all people fall under, and it's not individualized like it should be, but unfortunately our system has a lot of flaws, so and doesn't have the manpower to mm-hmm. really provide the individual need that's there.
Mm-hmm. If I may add, there is a rule, and I think it's 15 months or 22 months for guardianship or for permanency. So the DHS system, excuse me?
It's 18. It's 18 a federal
months.
Law.
Okay, federal law. So there's a rule in place okay. that that so DHS is doing their job and kids are protected, but at the same time, the average prison length sentence is 3 years. Mm-hmm. So they're going to constantly feed each other, and there's not ever a way out of that. So what I've seen with Kendra, what didn't work, but with another young woman, Ashley, is that when FPP or some other program at the front end can help interrupt and start communicating with these systems early, that there's ways around the terminacy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Representative Hack, did you have a question?
I did, but did you have one?
Representative
Hayden. Go ahead.
He was before me.
Okay, thank you, Chair Lively. So I have a question that has been lightly discussed, and it refers to the telemate phone system and the charging. Currently, Oregon's 31 ranks 31st in affordability of phone calls. That system charges you about 16 cents per minute to be used. My question is that rate considered a barrier, or is the, I guess, privilege to get to use the phone far outweigh, and then Oregon cost shifts about $3 million back to programs within the prison, from my understanding. I'm trying to get a sense for, is that a great deal? Is there barriers there that I'm not aware
of? Is 31 good or bad? I don't know. It's like the 31.
Well, it's just in the middle, right?
Oh, okay, it's in the
middle.
So
if there's
okay.
50 states and okay. affordability, yeah, so
we're 31st least affordable.
Yes,
we're the bottom half.
Okay.
We're more expensive.
So there's 30 states that it may be more economical to make that phone call. But those states, Oregon might argue that, yes, but we use the money for programs within the prison, which I think they do within the correctional facility. So I'm trying to get a flavor for, is that 16 cents a minute a barrier?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
It is. If you're...
Tell them how much you make a month.
Yeah. So depending on what your job is, you can't... Most women make around $24 a month. The best job in the women's facility would give you about $75 a month.
74.
Yeah. 74. If there's a month with more days, they do a cross point system, then you might make a little bit more. But that has to go to everything. And so, yes, that is a barrier because most people don't make any money. Most people don't have outside support. And then most people do need to make a phone call about something. Mm-hmm. And the correctional counselors, you don't go in their office. That's not appropriate to go in their office and be trying to be on their phone. There's all sorts of things that could happen with that, and it's not really their job to do that. I'm sure they do at times in certain situations, but if you need to call the caseworker or you need to call your attorney or you say you'd been got a traffic ticket for something else and now you're in prison and you need to call that court system to let them know where you are so they don't have to issue a warrant and do all this other legwork, you need to be able to get a hold of people and you need to be able to pay for your calls because not everybody accepts collect calls. Now, compared to my memory of what phone calls used to be 10 years ago, then it's way better, absolutely, but it's still a significant barrier. Where if you can pop into the FPP office, they're allowed to put you on speakerphone and you can do all your work real quick on speakerphone. So they're supervising, make sure you're not doing anything that you shouldn't be, and you get to handle whatever business type things you need to do.
Well, and if you do the math, so the max is, what, $74 that an inmate is making a month at a $3 phone call, and you do that once a week to call your child, I mean... Does it add up? No. And for a job, I was a carpenter for over 2 years in Coffee Creek, and I was making $74 a month. What does a carpenter make in the real world?
Yeah, and the $74 jobs are very limited. It's right. More like a $20 to $35 job.
Absolutely.
To be like more of an average. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hack.
Thank you. Nova, you mentioned the counseling mm-hmm. side. Can you talk a little bit more about that experience? And you kind of briefly touched on the fact that that's kind of not what they're there for. But
right.
I toured Coffee Creek and have toured pretty much, I think, all but one prison in the state. And that was of great concern to me, the lack of. So I'm curious if you could touch a little bit more on that for me, and then I have one other, if that's okay.
Sure. So my counseling experience there is that when I had gone in, I had let them know that I had a history of depression and anxiety, so I was able to access their BHS services, and I was willing to take medication. So I didn't have any of those, like if you're not willing to take medication, that bumps you into a different group. So I was able to get the services available. So as far as counseling, like in the traditional format of how are you doing? Are you stressed out? What do you need to talk about? You know, and delving in, then that would be through the BHS system, which my memory is that I would meet with somebody about once a month, roughly. And in the beginning, it was a lot about adjusting to my new surroundings. The BHS person on the medium side seemed to have enough time to be able to do the 30-minute chunks. Once I got to the minimum side, it was more about case management. So, and I was never a problem, so potentially maybe I would have got more time if I had been a problem, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. So there was that service. Then I had a correctional case manager, I think is the title, Mr. Wills, and I would meet with him more about, well, in the beginning it was bugging the heck out of him to get me into treatment, because even though the judge says you're eligible for treatment, you still have to meet the guidelines inside the Department of Corrections to actually get into treatment. It's not an automatic pass to treatment. And so I was on that fence of like, maybe I wouldn't get it because I'm less likely to recidivate. So I advocated. So I was always in his office going, I need this. I want to be a better person. I need this. And so he helped me do those things. He also helped me with my PO reach-in and getting back into the community. Know how you're doing, what's going on. So my real dealing with guilt and shame and domestic violence and addiction issues, that all came from my either attending AA and NA groups, religious groups, which all that's voluntary, or FPP.
So. I might have a couple. This it reiterates what I had seen and is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking in that you have to do something bad to get helped, and I hate that. And also the fact that you need treatment, but you have to advocate for that rather than let's be proactive. So I just am sorry for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's everybody's stressed out about money. I think that it would be different if they had enough money to do all those things. I don't think that they're bad people.
We won't go there. But
okay.
Anyway,
okay.
We might disagree on
okay.
that one.
Nice try, though.
Okay.
Priorities.
Some of us would agree up here.
Gotcha. That's fine.
Some of us would say it's about priorities okay. and where you put it.
That's fine.
But back to some of my original question and my thought. Another question that I do have, when you were released, I know that there are classes and different things that you have to take upon release. Were you given the option to take classes during the time that you were incarcerated so that when you left, you didn't have, again, another barrier to reentry? I know classes oftentimes cost money. I think on average, my understanding is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, probably $30 to $50 a class. And oftentimes, my understanding is you're given a block of 10 to 30 classes that you have to take after you leave that could be possibly taken while you're there. What was your experience with that?
My experience was that I double dipped in classes. I did the LIFT program and treatment, and then as soon as I paroled, I had to be in treatment again. Now, my understanding is that is the county, each county, it's up to them how they do it. I'm from Benton County, so Benton County wants you to automatically go into outpatient treatment, which is another 4 months of classes. Okay, I mean, I was going to do what I was told. I had Oregon Health Plan, so I didn't end up having to pay anything. What I did have was my supervision fees that I'd have to pay, which I think was in the beginning around $40 a month. And then as I became less of a issue or whatever, I was proving myself, my fines went down or my fees went down. But yeah, I almost the exact same classes that I did on inpatient treatment while I was in the institution, I then also did in my community.
My experience, FPP actually provided most of the transitional aspects to things. So like what it would look like upon release, housing stuff, calling DMV, being part of LIFT as well. I had some pre-release classes. My experience, they weren't all that beneficial. I mean, a few classes that taught me how to do interviews, which I already knew how to conduct a good interview. But the reality upon getting released is actually going to get a job from an employer who will hire you, mm-hmm. being a felon. And then I also had aftercare. I'm from Lane County. The aftercare took up a lot of my time. I had all these probation requirements. So I was very fortunate to land a job at a detox center. And so they're very flexible with my treatment schedule and everything that I had to do. My fines and fees in order to even just get my license reinstated and be able to drive, which I currently still pay over $200 a month just to be able to drive. And that's not including insurance and car payment. That's just on the state side. And then you add on top of that my probation fines, which I'm on a mail-in status. So I write a letter or fill out a form, and I pay $40 a month to do that. And I never see a probation officer. So that's what my...
So, and I'm not saying it should be easy for
right.
you. I mean, I get that. I'm not saying that. I just... I just hate the barrier after barrier after barrier.
Absolutely.
And just keep kicking you while you're down.
Absolutely.
And I don't get the impression from either one of you that you thought it should be easy either. One last thing, and I'm done, you guys, I swear. If you could change one thing, your top one thing, what would it be?
Change it where?
I know, I'm like,
where?
In the system.
What? In the
one
system.
Thing in the
I didn't
system.
Know where we were talking about.
One thing in the system, what would it be?
In the system for women,
yep.
I would like to see, rather than the work-based programs, which I know will have to be, but having a family focus program that anybody who's going to be a mom, is a mom, has been a mom, that there's more of a focus on that holistic woman approach, and that that we don't focus so much on the punitive part inside a female's prison, and we focus more on a restorative part, so when she gets back out in the community, she gives back and wants to do something different. I just feel like that's what I've experienced, and it's been amazing, and I would like more people to have that.
I would have to agree, only I would take it farther and focus more into the community aspect with our law enforcement, with DHS, all these different entities that really our systems don't seem to be designed to help people succeed, and I would like to see that change.
Representative Peluso, and then Representative Bateman.
So I just want to acknowledge you folks for being here today. Great kudos to the Y, because I don't think we wouldn't be here today without the support of the YWCA, and so always proud to be associated with that organization. You guys are doing great stuff. You have done great stuff. You know, I was fortunate, and some of us were, to speak with you at greater length, so I won't go on. I'll just say I am just very sorry I didn't check my schedule, I'd be wearing my pink shirt. So I apologize for that, but keep it up and face forward and move on, and you're doing great things. Certainly you have my support on both Senate Bill 242 and 241.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
You get your green link. Well, I just want to say thank you on behalf of my kids for whoever at Coffee Creek creates the rocking horses.
Aww.
We have two of those very cute little rocking horses that we ordered from that catalog. And hopefully those types of programs that enable people to use such a skill in woodworking and art and crafts are helpful.
There's some really cool programs there. The concern is that it only allows a couple people to be in each one of them, and I don't know why that is.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. And unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but we have two more people, Marianne Karsten and Samantha Furlow. But this has been very educational today and informative, and it certainly, I think, reinforces the family supports part of our mission and things we can be looking at in the future. So welcome.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing us to have this time. I'll try and be brief and shorten up my... My name is Mary Ann Kirsten, and I manage the Children of Incarcerated Parents Program at Northwest Family Services. As we know, children of incarcerated parents are a largely invisible population out there, and we that work with them see firsthand in their homes, in their schools, on a daily basis, the profound effects that arrest and incarceration has on them and the price that they're forced to pay. Our kiddos' lives are cluttered with obstacles, including neglect, abuse, poverty, criminality, and on top of it, the shame and stigma of having a parent in jail. Our students in our programs have an average A score of 9, with some of them having experienced all 10 of those adverse childhood experience criteria. They are hugely at risk. One of our programs, Youth Solutions Student Mentoring, strives to empower these kiddos through mentorship. Our kids are matched with a caring adult who offers them unconditional support and guidance that is so often missing in their lives. We connect them with a myriad of services, anything they need, food, clothing, school fees, piano lessons, driver's ed. But most of all, we advocate for them. A quick story. I mentor a young lady whose dad is serving a life sentence for murder. Mother is completely surrendered to her drug and alcohol addiction, and she has very little support at home. But I meet with her every week for the past 4 years. Sometimes we just run to Powell's for coffee. I see what she needs. A lot of times I bring her down here to Salem to see her dad, who's really the only other good, positive role model in her life, which is astounding because he's serving a life sentence, but he's a remarkable man. They were evicted from their apartment last year, and her and I navigated her homeless status together, and I was able to land her at her aunt's house. But before I began working with her, her life was really small. She saw very little other than her apartment, her school, and her little neighborhood.
How old is she?
She is now 18. But since then, with my help, she was able to join Future Farmers of America and raise a tiny spring lamb, which she ended up taking all the way to the Clackamas County Fair and took fifth place out of 500 lambs. It was her first time ever on fairgrounds in her life. We partnered with the Rotary, and for 2 years we worked to get her. She's in her third year of Japanese, and she spent last summer in Japan on a study abroad. When I spoke to her about her plans after high school, she said, "I have none. I assume I'll get a job." And we started addressing the possibility of her going to college. And nobody in her life had ever mentioned college as being an option to her. And we began visiting colleges, talking to admissions, a huge amount of obstacles, no tax returns, no support. In fact, her family said it was a waste of time, that it was just the government getting more money. And we persevered, and this September, this child will be the first in her entire family in any direction to be attending Western Oregon University. Mm. So that's just... that's just really, really exciting. And we see this every day, this little bit of intervention in these kids' lives really, really making a change. One of our most successful, another strategy for helping little ones is our Big Challenges program. We take a support group into Clackamas County Elementary Schools, and we provide these little kiddos who have a parent in jail support and coping strategies and comfort in a school setting. We've had countless groups who these little kiddos give up their recesses, they give up their lunches, and they come to us, and we sit in class in a room, and they often think they're completely alone. And their parents have said, "Don't say anything. You'll be blacklisted. You won't have any friends." And these kiddos come into a room, and they sit, and they look around, and they see six or eight kids that they know from walking down the hall or that they sit next to in class that also have a parent in jail. And it is really miraculous. We help them really realize who they can count on. They do have a support system. They're not alone. And it is absolutely, absolutely miraculous. Part of this curriculum is an educational toolkit put out by Sesame Street called Big Challenges. And Alex, a new character on Sesame Street, has a parent in jail. And it is remarkable with these little kiddos, helping them not feel so alone. We put these toolkits in the hands of every Clackamas County Elementary School. We are getting them out to Head Start, faith groups, family resource coordinators, preschools, health navigators, and they are absolutely just really well received. We're currently partnering with Clackamas County Children's Commission Head Start to implement this same service for preschoolers, these groups. We know for sure that with early intervention for these kiddos who face these colossal burdens, it's just absolutely crucial that we get them early. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Lively, and members of the committee for this opportunity to share my program with you today. I know that we're running late, and I'm going to go quickly. My name is Samantha Furlow, and I represent Northwest Family Services, where I'm the Parenting Education Coordinator. I teach and coordinate parenting classes, which include Parenting Inside Out, abbreviated to PIO. PIO is the only evidence-based parenting class created specifically for justice-involved families used in America today. Parents often come to my PIO class after being released from incarceration, while they are seeking intensive treatment or as an alternative to incarceration. It's often the final piece of supervision that these parents are going through. In the past 6 years, over 600 parents in Clackamas County have graduated from my Parenting Inside Out program. Of those parents, 1,200 children are represented. 780 of those children fall into the 0 to 5 age demographic. 3/4 of these participants have a required court mandation to successfully complete parent education in order to regain or maintain their parenting rights. We reconnect with families 1 to 2 years after completion. 98% of parents surveyed reported they either maintained or increased their parenting time after completion of the Parenting Inside Out program. 55% report that they're no longer involved with the criminal justice system. I work very closely with the POs, the caseworkers, whoever is referring them, in order to create wraparound services. We work very hard to break down all barriers. This class is provided to all participants free of charge. I cook a meal for them so they can have a warm meal. We provide free TriMet bus passes. We also provide free child care. I notice that many of these children, especially the 0 to 5 that come into our child care, have never experienced preschool. I used my previous career knowledge of education to create a child care curriculum that hits Common Core state standards. Most of these kids, this is the first school experience they've ever had. Parents come to our program isolated and alone. They're scared of the community agencies and doubtful that a parenting class can benefit their lives. Through our 12-week series, parents build a community where they practice identifying their parenting values, they safely discuss conflicting opinions, and support each other despite sharing different priorities and ideas. Together, our parenting community learns how to hold ourselves accountable, forgive ourselves for past mistakes, create parenting goals, understand the importance of identifying our support network, the necessity of asking for help, and understanding the long-lasting impacts of child abuse and neglect. The focus in PIO is for the adults to change their behaviors through the utilization of parent management training. By serving the parents and teaching them new skills, we are empowering the children and giving them the opportunity to grow up in a pro-social home with strength-based parenting techniques. The program is outcome-based, learner-centered, and uses social learning theory to teach cooperation and problem-solving in the context of learning new parenting skills. Parents develop and refine social interactional skills and citizenship behaviors that help them guide their children toward becoming positive, constructive adults. Graduating parents will all leave with a metaphorical parenting toolbox filled with tools to practice and teach effective communication skills, child-centered play techniques, positive discipline, emotion regulation, child development from birth through adulthood, co-parenting strategies, and a stronger trust in their community and the agencies within. After I've built trust with families, takes a few weeks to a month, I begin resource matching. I get parents to get their kids into Head Start. I hook them up with school advocates. I connect them with holiday adopt-a-family gift programs. I connect them with food pantries, clothes closets. I have a partnership with all of the Clackamas County Libraries to donate their used books to me. So now all of my parents leave with piles of books after learning active reading strategies in conjunction with kindergarten readiness. We connect them with free music lessons, summer camps, funding for extracurriculars, and I will spend as many hours as it takes, whether it's paid or unpaid, to resource match with all of these families. I have families calling me 3 months after graduation, a year after graduation, asking me, how do I get to Head Start? How do I do this? They remember that we are a service to them. I'm also the administrator for the Clackamas County Children of Incarcerated Parents Committee. The mission of our committee is to collaboratively work to provide resources and advocacy to youth and families impacted by the justice system and bring awareness and education to communities. Clackamas County is a leader in addressing the issues surrounding children impacted by parental incarceration. We fulfill our mission by providing community education, developing and implementing social services, hosting conferences for professional development, and consistently serving the many needs of families that are impacted by involvement in the justice system. Our committee is a network including Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, Community Corrections, Public Schools, Community Colleges, CTEC, Girl Scouts Beyond Bars, local nonprofits, and faith-based communities. We come together to navigate through the barriers children of incarcerated parents are constantly up against. Our committee conveys information back into the local Public Safety Coordinating Council and other community stakeholders. I'm here because I'm passionate about this population, and I'm devoted to the reunification of families affected by criminality. Because parent education is a key piece to early childhood intervention. Thank you for your time, and we're open to any questions.
Thank you. We appreciate your passion.
Yes.
Absolutely, and the work you do. I mean, it's tremendous work, obviously, and it's we all gain from that. So thank you very much.
Wow.
And we apologize that we just ran late on time, but great work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, we close the informational hearing, and I'll close the informational hearing, and I'll
excellent. Thank you.
Okay.